You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
On the line, joining us from who knows where, he recently authored a biography about the legendary Chris Knox, one-of-a-kind New Zealand musician. The book is called Not Given Lightly, very, very fitting given that was Chris Knox's maybe most mainstream accepted track. And I'm very happy to say we've got Craig Robertson on the line here for a corridor about this book and more about Chris Knox's life. Good morning to you, Craig. How are we?
I'm pretty good, thanks, and it's great to be here. You know, it's a long time since I'm not in the Radio 1 studio, but since I had something to do with Radio 1 back in the day, so it's kind of like, you know, almost a full circle moment.
You were saying before you used to host the New Zealand Music Show and you had another couple of shows here. When about did you join the station?
So this was like, would have been late 1980s, early 1990s, so we're talking last century, you know. But it does look like the studio has not changed that much.
Not a whole lot. That's what everyone says. But that's really cool to be in on the kind of ground floor, because Radio 1 was still very young back in those days.
It was pretty young, but even for me, like, I grew up in Dunedin, and I had been listening to it as a high school student, and for me it was a big deal to host what we called the New Zealand Music Show, because when I was, like, in, you know, 13 and 14, I just listened to it religiously on Radio 1, and there were some crazy DJs back in the day. There's this guy, David Merritt, who's now sort of, you know, the people's poet, I guess, of New Zealand. But he used to be, if you know your New Zealand music, he used to be the manager of a band called the Screaming Memes. But I remember one week I tuned in and him and his friend had decided that because they thought the lyrics of the English band The Fall were super conversational, that they would only speak for an entire week using the lyrics of The Fall. And so you tune into the show and you're trying to figure out what is going on. And I needed a friend who was a Fall fan to translate it for me and say, this is what Dave Merritt is doing. But anyway, Radio 1, really formative for me growing up in Dunedin, you know, and connecting me to, Flying Nun Music and Chris Knox as well.
Mm-hmm. I want to start by asking, you know, from reading the books and things I've heard about Chris, he can be a very polarizing figure for pretty obvious reasons. I mean, he lacerates himself on stage. He's got a bit of a snappy persona. What was your interpretation of him when you started writing? I know that you once called him Christopher at a party or a gig, and he said, only my parents call me that. But
that was the first time I spoke to him at an orientation gig over at the Union. On the Otago campus. Yeah, I think, I definitely had been on the end of Chris's withering criticism a couple of times because I was I wrote for Rip It Up and I was a music writer. I think in one of the things I discovered in, you know, as I researched the book, right, was that there is more to him. Like, he's that. Like, he's opinionated. He can be an arsehole. He can be incredibly juvenile. But at the same time, he's also this actually quite thoughtful person who, you know, produced all this, like, you know, music and cartoons and visual culture from a pretty clearly defined, like, kind of aesthetic and worldview. Though you'd be sometimes forgiven for thinking there was nothing there, but just, you know, some anger and, you know, and bitterness.
I think the book, from what I've read so far, gives a very well-rounded impression of him. He's very loyal to his friends, even if that means he's going to be brutally honest to them about their music or their music taste, you know. And that seemed to be quite a big deal for him back in the 70s, was what you listened to and what he could kind of, talk to you about that.
Music became really, really important for him. Like, in the 70s, he was listening to it more than making it. But even when he, you know, started making music, you know, with The Enemy and Toy Love and then Tall Dwarfs, you know, he had clear opinions about what was good music and what was bad music. And, you know, he would let people know, right? And in some ways, you know, those tastes were really limiting. Were limited, I should say. But in other ways, you know, I think they push people to have to justify their own taste. But yeah, I mean, he has no time for fools, right? He has no time for casual music listeners, right? Like, you know, you got to go in all the way. Right.
Yeah, that seems like a kind of another thing. He's a little bit of an extremophile, which is great. I really appreciate that of him. You've said that being a biographer is about connecting people's memories to tell a bigger story. Now, that's hard to do when your subject can't really speak in full sentences. Thankfully, Mr. Knox has kept all his old memorabilia and paraphernalia and art from the 70s up until now in a big, extensive collection. Just how extensive is this archive of Chris's?
Yeah, well, it's kind of spread around his house. I mean, he's lived in the same house in Grey Lynn since 1984. So anyone who lives in a house that long is going to collect a lot of stuff. Mm. And Chris, I found like he has these ring binders that were his journals from the 1970s, and they're on a shelf in his sort of front room office, right? And on the page of one of those, he describes himself on a bit of paper that he stuck to a larger bit of paper. He describes himself as like an egotistical hoarder, you know, so, you know, he definitely has those hoarding tendencies. And so there's a lot there. When I started out, it wasn't particularly well ordered, but a friend came in actually and helped sort of curate this archive. So there's a lot there. There's a lot that's not there, but there, you know, if you're a biographer, it was a great base, you know, to start from. So he's got like clippings and diaries from some parts of his life, but not others, right? So as the biographer, you have to try and work with the sources, you know, that you have. But the house itself is just this amazing archive with Chris's art all over the walls, his famous tape loops hanging from doors, you know, an old, you know, Disney comics piled up in the corner. I mean, it's like, yeah, every time I go there, I'm like, wow. You know, this is definitely like a monument within New Zealand culture, for sure.
When you're talking to people about such a polarizing character, how do you make fact or fiction of what they're saying?
Yeah, it's a tough one. I mean, you know, like, you know, I have to rely on people's memories because I'm, you know, I'm a lot younger than Chris. I didn't know him that well, you know, so I had to work with other people's memories, you know, and you know, and then also I'm asking people to remember like 30, 40, 50 years ago, right? And so, you know, people have different memories of things. They often contradict Chris's memories of things. Chris's own memories change, you know, from what he remembered in the 1980s to what he remembered in the early 2000s. So you just, you know, you sort of start to get a feel for Chris and his friends, you know, and I think that helped me sort of figure out, you know, I think this is the version to run with, right? Or sometimes it's just, this is the better story, you know?
Yeah,
so,
completely.
You know, and let's go with that. Because as we were talking about, you know, earlier, like there are a lot of really funny stories that I came across that are in the book. And a lot of those come from, you know, Chris's friends, right, talking about certain things that have happened. And I feel like, you know, those people that I talked to, you know, I talked to over 80 people, and they were great. They all offered these great insights. They all had their own stories that, honestly, half of them deserve their own biographies. You know, these are like just fascinating, interesting people, right? So yeah, it's this responsibility to tell this story, you know, and to tell it well, not just Chris's, but the whole, you know, the creative communities he's part of.
I think one of my favourite anecdotes from the book, from what I've read so far, is as soon as he got out of university, him and his mate bought dogs, and his mate called one Bent and he called his Straight. It's just like that kind of classic Kiwi humour, you know, he's such a character.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, Chris, you know, Chris is a genuinely funny guy. He lives and dies by the bad pun. Like, there's absolutely no doubt about that, right? But yeah, I mean, and that again, when you're writing that book, and I hope, you know, the initial comments I've got suggest I pulled it off, right? Like, you know, I want the book to be funny in parts because that's who he is, right? And even though he can't talk to me, you know, I want to make sure his voice is there, you know, on as many pages in the book, you know, as possible.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting reading about Chris's father, Fred, who is, you know, compared to Chris, quite conservative, normal guy. You know, he was a stockbroker. He was the head of the New Zealand Freemasons, which is pretty buzzy. Whereas Chris was cheeky growing up. He loved horror. He loved rock music and making all sorts of silly cartoons and drawings. You know, how did they get on as Chris got older?
Yeah, again, I have to rely on Chris's sort of memories as he wrote wrote about his relationship with his father at different points. But yeah, I mean, I think there were some times when they, you know, they did not see eye to eye and they didn't get on, you know, through, say, a lot of the 1980s. But then Chris says, you know, Chris had kids, right? Two kids. And if you give someone grandkids, the whole dynamic changes, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, that changed the relationship. And Fred passed away in 1999. But by that point, you know, Chris believes that his father had kind of made peace, like, this is who Chris is, like, and then the realization that New Zealand and people around the world were taking his son seriously, you know, as like a musician, as a social commentator. I think, like, you know, there was a sense from his father's point of view that, you know, Chris had made it, even if making it was, you know, was not quite in the area, like he wasn't a doctor or a lawyer or a stockbroker or a Freemason.
Yeah, it was fascinating learning that at the earliest opportunity, his parents, Fred and June, told him that he was adopted. And he was fine with it. He did not really care.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, in the 1950s and 60s in New Zealand, when he's growing up, particularly in Invercargill, you know, adoption carries a real stigma. You know, but yeah, I mean, he seemed pretty fine with it. His friends teased him about it, right? You know, that's an easy thing to pick on him about. But he said, like, growing up, like, what was more odd for him was that he was an only child, right? Because we're in the boomer generation here. Like, it's kind of crazy to think of Chris Knox as a boomer, right? You know, but, you know, he is, right? And so all his friends had 2-3 siblings, right? So it was that only child stuff that I think he found odd and kind of stressful at times growing up.
Mm-hmm. I think it, you know, added to his character. You were talking before about, you know, finding it difficult to track down the memories about Chris in these times, because a lot of them are from the 70s and 80s. That's 40, 50 years ago. But one thing I also want to know is that there were so many drugs floating around in Dunedin at the time that would have made those memories even hazier. And there's a really fascinating period where LSD was more common than marijuana in Dunedin. And one of the reasons why was this aircraft engineer who came back from the US, and he used to just sit in a pub and sometimes hand out LSD for free. Who is this guy? He should have his own biography.
I know, that's what I'm saying, right? You know, there are so many great stories, you know, to be told, right? I actually don't know who he is. Another person, a friend of Chris's, told me that story, right? Yeah, and so it was one of those things that not only, so this guy bought all this, you know, LSD in gel form, in gel capsules, like stuffed inside a car that he brought back from the US, and he claimed it was what the Grateful Dead were taking. But the other source of it was the US military who were going down to Antarctica to work at the base that was military base that was down in Antarctica, and they would come through Christchurch, and that apparently, according to those who know their drug history in New Zealand, that was also a main source of it. Yeah, so it's an interesting time, right, to, you know, to experiment with drugs. And for Chris, coming from a fairly conservative background, Dunedin, you know, provides this, you know, like this, all these opportunities, even though by the 1990s, he'll be slagging off Dunedin, you know, to anyone who wants to listen. But when he was here, like in the 70s, it really did, like, open up his world.
That's interesting, because it seemed like, from what I've read so far, he kind of has a love-hate relationship with Dunedin. He feels, it's like he's quite bipolar about it, really. Why was he, by the 90s, not such a fan of Dunedin?
Well, because he's Chris, right? So one of the things I really realized, you know, is he's a provocateur. Like, that's his default mode of being in the world, right? And so he'll provoke. So, you know, a lot of his, you know, the musicians that, you know, who followed in his wake were still in Dunedin, you know, and he would give them shit about Dunedin and its crappy weather and, you know, whatever it was. I mean, I don't think he really held any grudge against Dunedin, but he knew it was a great way to rile people up and, you know, that's like a red flag to a bull that is Chris Knox, right? Like, many people told me this, right, that, like, you know, one skill that Chris had was that he could figure out someone's weakness and insecurity, you know, almost instantly. And then he would go after you and he would needle you, you know.
Just push your buttons.
Yeah.
It's fascinating watching one of the old editions of Radio with Pitches when they come down to Dunedin and hearing Chris talk about the other bands in such a derogative way, just saying that they're all kind of derivative of him or the Clean. It's about, like, so many incredible bands. It's hilarious.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, again, like, Chris wants to provoke, right? But also, I think Chris's whole, you know, like he didn't want acolytes. Like he didn't want people following him and doing what he did. Like his sort of core belief, right, was that, you know, that creative expression is like one of the most important, like, personal and social forms of communication. And so if you're, you know, and to be creative is to express yourself and your point of view. So that's what I'm saying. Like, there's, you know, there's always this performative needling kind of element, but usually there is like this sort of pretty coherent sort of worldview or aesthetic behind it, right? So for him, it's like, yeah, music needs to be the expression of the person who's created it. It can't be overly mediated by technology, right? Like, it's got to be something where you can really feel and hear, you know, the person and their point of view.
It's interesting reading that he went to university, and after that he felt, it seems like he felt quite stuck. Like a few years after that, he was caught stealing a Harry Nilsson record, and then some friends of his went on a sort of pilgrimage in the search of nothing, as they put it. And really what they did is they just went on a road trip to go and see the rest of the country, and Chris seemed to have fallen in love with Auckland. But did they find nothing? Because it seems like Chris was definitely running from something.
Maybe not running from something, but he was looking for something. Right. Like, you know, absolutely. And I think, you know, Dunedin was starting to get maybe a little claustrophobic for him, but he definitely throughout. And this is one of the questions I really, you know, really wish I could have asked him. Right. Because no one ever asked him about this fascination with nothing. So he's on that quest for nothing. You know, the Tour de Wharf's first single is Nothing's Gonna Happen. You know, he calls his last band Chris Knox and the Nothing. Mm. Like, he has this real fascination with the idea of nothing, you know, and what that means. He called a van, the enemy's van was called Nothing. So maybe nothing can be something, you know, like, you know, but he, you know, he, but I feel that that trip you're talking about, like, it was a road trip, but it was just, you know, LSD all the way. So in that sense, nothing was less philosophical, I think, and more like meditation and drugs, right? But by the end of his life, you know, I think his creative life, you know, he's still, like, nothing has become this thing he's fascinated by, this idea of nothing.
Mm, the idea of absence, one might say.
Yes.
It's quite surreal reading that when Chris Knox's first band spilt onto the scene, his contemporaries were mostly cover bands, and there wasn't actually a proper professional recording studio in Otipoti, Dunedin. How come Dunedin wasn't as bold with its music as it was with its art and literature up to that point?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I mean, I think, yeah, I mean, to be fair, you know, there were original bands, you know, in New Zealand making, you know, original music. But most major cities, the live music scene was covers bands, you know, cover bands. Even when Chris went up to Auckland with the Enemy to see this great punk scene, they discovered that most of the bands had two or three original songs and the rest of them had covers, right? And so Wilson played covers. So, you know, so I think there, you know, I don't want to beat up Dunedin too much, right? But yeah, I mean, it was a covers music scene. So apparently some of those covers bands were really great, like great musicians. But yeah, no recording studio, obviously nothing at university, like, you know, there's no Radio One. So yeah, they went out onto the Otago Peninsula into this guy's living room, where he had like a real basic kind of two-track reel-to-reel setup. And he'd only ever recorded a cappella groups and classical music groups, you know, and the Enemy arrive and try to record punk, and his wife takes the kids and they go hide in the bedroom, you know, because as you're saying, this is what, you know, that's what music was, right? And obviously by the 1980s, music studios start to appear in Dunedin, but still they're small, right? Compared, there's just not the demand because it's still a small scene, you know, and Auckland was where it was at. And so you went to Auckland to record.
That's so fascinating. It seems like the, you know, the massive amount of musical creativity that came out of not only Dunedin but also the rest of the country in the 80s was sort of a reaction against the creative conservatism in New Zealand. You know, you had Johnny Devlin in the 60s and 50s. He was a massive act, and he was essentially just an Elvis Presley impersonator. Or you had that Conway Twitty impersonator from like the 30s and 40s. You know, it seemed like New Zealand was overdue for a massive musical revolution.
Yeah, I mean, again, there are some really great original bands in the 60s and 70s, right? But they tend to be the exception. So yeah, I mean, I think this is obviously one of Chris's most immediate impacts, right? He didn't start Flying Nun, but he pushed Flying Nun in a direction and in a way that I don't know if that would have gone there without him, right? And you know, and that made a major impact on the New Zealand music industry. Like it completely changed how people thought about the music industry and what you could create, you know, how you could go about it, what was acceptable. I mean, you know, the mainstream music industry still thought Flying Nun Records sounded crap, but the point was that they were being made, they were being reviewed in the newspapers, you know, and in the 80s, student radio starts, right, which suddenly gives this whole other outlet, right? So, you know, again, Chris is, you know, this would have happened in some way without Chris, right? But Chris definitely was at the forefront of this, you know, of this change in New Zealand music. And I think that's a real interesting part of his story, you know, of his biography.
It is. He's also a bit of a trendsetter in the form of self-harm on stage. You know, forget T.G. Allen and Marilyn Monroe, because on one night when playing at a University of Canterbury orientation gig, he ate a light bulb, which is pretty extraordinary. How did he live after that? What must have been, was it a small light bulb?
Yeah, I assume it was a small light bulb. I tried to find out more. People have hazy memories of this. Some people said he never did, but a critical mass claimed that he did. I don't know. The question is, he definitely bit into it. Perhaps he didn't swallow a lot of it, right? But again, you know, he wanted to provoke. Like one of his life sort of long obsessions has been the body, the human body, right? And the way in which people evaluate beauty and ugliness, right? And so he went through a lot of, you know, as a teenager, he felt that he was overweight, he felt that he was ugly. And I think, you know, that the cutting he used to do on his arms was part of like wanting people to feel uncomfortable with their bodies and their place in the world. And, you know, by the 1990s, he'd stopped cutting himself, but he started licking people's faces. Like he would go into the audience, right? Or he would go into the audience and bury his head into their crotch. Now, like, you know, I was at gigs in the 1990s, but when I was reading this, you know, in the 2020s, I was like, man, the 90s, yeah, they were definitely something special, you know, where essentially you've got someone assaulting people and everyone loves it,
and they're
you
paying
know,
for it to happen,
and they're paying for it and they love it, right? You know, but for Chris again, he wanted, like, for him it was about like making people question literally their physical place in the world as they stand at a gig, right? And trying to think about their body and what is normal and what is acceptable. I mean, he really saw himself as someone who lived outside of the mainstream, you know, and therefore his job was to kick against the pricks, right? His job was to needle people, you know, and you know, make them think, right? To challenge them, not just for the, you know, the spectacle of it.
Yeah, I know you've got to head off very shortly, but I have one last question. Chris was game for you to be quite honest about him with this biography. He wouldn't have it any other way. What kind of impression do you think the reader will glean from your book of Chris?
Yeah, great question. I mean, I really hope they see him as, like, you know, this complex person, because I think he is a complex person. He's full of contradictions, right? You don't go to this book expecting me to be able to write some coherent logical explanation of Chris Knox, right? Like, he, you know, he's an interesting person because of all these very contradictions and these contradictions. And I think the other thing, on a kind of more less, you know, abstract level, I just really want people to realize that, yes, he's a musician, but also, you know, he's a visual artist, right? And in fact, from the 1990s on, he sees music as this hobby that he does a couple of, you know, 2 weeks a year, he records a record, an album, right? And the rest of the time, he's drawing cartoons, he's writing opinion pieces, he's, you know, he's doing comics for the listener. He had one of the longest running cartoons in New Zealand in the New Zealand Herald, you know, and so he was a social commentator. I mean, he could be juvenile, he could be stupid and silly, right, just for the sake of it, but he also could be, you know, a very thoughtful person. And it's that side of him that I think really allows us to not only understand him a little better as one of New Zealand's most, I think, unique individual voices, but also to understand New Zealand and New Zealand culture a little better through, you know, through what he was reacting to and how he was accepted and not accepted in the time.
Mm-hmm. I think I definitely have gotten certainly those impressions from the book completely. Thank you so much for your time, Craig. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Zach. It's been great. Cheers.
Take care, man. All right, folks. That was Craig Robertson, the author of a new Chris Knox biography called Not Given Lightly. It seems only fitting to play Not Given Lightly from Chris Knox right now, so we're going to do that. You are indeed listening to The One. If you are interested in buying this book, you can do so at AucklandUniversityPress.co.nz as well as the Flying Nun website. Here is Chris Knox with Not Given Lightly. You're listening to The One. Keep it locked.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.